Apple Watch unfortunately, the technology inside there and the sensors is not good enough for diagnostic purposes.
But like maybe a screening tool, maybe perhaps.
Some research is still being done.
Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of our podcast. Alright, so over here today we have Dr. Tan Mei Hui, and she is a oral maxillofacial surgeon. Alright, yeah. So Dr. Tan graduated from NUS, and then she then further on specialized in oral and maxillofacial surgery. And then she's a very talented surgeon, okay, and her interest is in dental implants, teeth auto-transplantation. We gotta get about that later on. And then autonetic surgery, which is basically surgery of the jaw, and also obstructive sleep apnea. So today's focus would be talking about sleep apnea and also other aspects of oral surgery that we don't really need to know of that we should know. All right. She served as the head and consultant of the OMS department at Changi General Hospital. And then she went to a few places before. She has gone about a few places before. So, and she also went abroad many times to Stanford University Hospital, to Changguan Memorial Hospital in Taiwan, and she's also the service chief for the NUS Duke Sleep Center, overlooking the dental sleep medicine services. All right, so she also teaches and. She has also won an award for teachers. So she's really, really talented. So I'm really, really pleased to have her on board here today. All right. Welcome, Dr. Tan. All
right, hi, anyway. Justin. Thanks Hello. For having me.
All right. So let's talk more about sleep apnea. All right. So what is sleep apnea?
Sleep apnea is actually the collapse of an airway.
Okay.
During sleep, when there is an effort to breathe, and yet the upper airway is actually collapsing and obstructing. And that results in what we call obstructive sleep apnea.
Okay, okay. Are there other forms of sleep apnea?
Yes. There is a central sleep apnea. And so that happens when there is an effort to breathe.
Yeah.
But, let me repeat that. Central sleep apnea is when there is no effort to breathe. The brain is not sending a signal for the patient to breathe. Then there is no breath and no oxygenation happening. So then that's central sleep apnea.
Okay.
And that's not due to an obstruction of the airway. So it's not due to collapse of an airway. It's just there is no signals from the brain to breathe.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. That's a lot more alarming. Yeah. All right. So, and people always say, if I'm snoring, is that considered sleep apnea?
So snoring alone may not represent sleep apnea.
Yeah.
Snoring is just one of the symptoms that patients with obstructive sleep apnea may have, but not all patients who snore have obstructive sleep apnea.
Okay, so I could be like, snoring, and then it's not considered sleep apnea because I still can breathe in air. Am I right?
Yes. Okay, yeah. So the sound of snoring itself is produced by vibrations. Yep. From the soft palate, when there's some turbulent airflow, and that produces a snoring sound. But as long as you are continuously breathing, there's no cessation of airflow, you didn't stop breathing, and your oxygen levels did not drop, then that's just benign snoring.
That's okay, yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's okay.
Okay, okay, cool. It's an interesting question. Would snoring affect your quality of sleep?
So snoring itself won't affect your quality of sleep.
Yeah.
But it can affect your bed partner's quality of sleep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So oftentimes the person who is snoring is oblivious, happily sleeping, enjoying a good rest. It might be affecting the person next to him or her. Yes, because ladies do snore too. And so then sometimes this might be an issue, and sometimes people might want to sleep.
Ladies, is it? Like a gender proportion to snoring and sleep apnea?
For snoring itself, there is not enough evidence to say whether,
males sleep more,
snore more than females, but the truth is females do snore.
Yeah.
they're just less likely to talk about it. It's kind of like a social stigma. There's less ladies who want to admit that they snore. Whereas okay. The guys are like, yeah, it's normal. A guy snore. It's really accepted that men snore. Okay. So then they happily admit that I snore or my wife complains that I snore. But in terms of obstructive sleep apnea, then yes, there is a stronger male predilection. There are more men with sleep apnea than women.
Is there a reason why? Like, is it because of obesity? Like more, like bigger?
It's not obesity itself. It's, we don't really know the exact causation in it, but there's just a very strong gender link. Yes.
Really? Okay.
Yes, for obstructive sleep apnea.
Okay. Correct. Okay. And so, like, you know, I mean, it sounds very scary really when people say that, you know, when people say that you're not breathing intermittently, right? Because sleep apnea is like, you know, how you have sleep apnea is when you're snoring, then you get really, sort of high frequent breath, like, then you're like trying to gasp for air, right?
Or there can be silence.
Okay,
there can
be silence, right?
There can be silence where there's really no breath, no air that's passing through, and there's just silence for a period.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next moment, the patient will actually start snoring very loudly again. That's when there's an airflow again.
Okay.
Or the patient actually wakes up, just a little, we call it arousal, micro-arousal. And it's like the brain is sending a signal to say, wake up and breathe. And so the patient just shifts a bit, wakes up a bit. And that's enough to disrupt their sleep cycle.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
And that can be disruptive to the rest, the kind of restful sleep that they can get as well. Yeah.
Okay. And like what are the, I mean, obviously it's not great for the body, I would think, but what are the serious sort of health consequences for that, you know?
Well, obstructive sleep apnea has been linked to many comorbidities such as high blood pressure, diabetes, increased risk of cardiovascular heart diseases, and even leading to heart attack and stroke.
Yeah.
And it has also been linked to dementia, cognitive decline, because of the lack of oxygen to the brain.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this can have a lot of health consequences for untreated, severe sleep apnea, especially.
You know what? My father-in-law, he used to have a lot of sleep apnea until he got a CPAP. We'll talk about CPAP later. But like he before he had a CPAP, before he had treatment for the sleep apnea.
Yeah.
He would have micro sleeps when driving. That's not cool. Like he would just
doze off
while driving. Then that's when accidents happen, right?
Yes, that's just one of the symptoms as well. Yeah. I mean, that it presents with excessive daytime sleepiness, feeling very sleepy during the day, just very not energized and just falling asleep anywhere easily. Yeah.
So it's a very big thing, and How do you diagnose, when you see a patient, how do you diagnose a sleep apnea? Like, do you bring them to sleep study or how does it work?
Yep. So basically, the diagnosis of sleep apnea is through a sleep study. But of course, we will look for signs and symptoms. We look, do a clinical examination first and see whether they present with some risk factors and through a questionnaire, just like the stop bang questionnaire. Where we assess for snoring, tiredness, obesity, and in the Asian...
Oh, stop bang,
stop bang,
Okay. So to actually learn whether they are like sort of predisposition.
Yes, correct. Okay. We screen them first because if they have a moderate to high risk of OSA based on a stop bang score and with the clinical presentations, then we would order a sleep study for these patients.
Okay.
Yeah.
And like how does a sleep study work? Do you go home? Or do you stay in the hospital?
So there are different kinds of sleep study. So a level one sleep study, what we call as a level one polysomnography, is a study that's done in a hospital or in a sleep lab.
Okay.
With attending person, usually a trained sleep technician that will be observing the patient the whole night.
Throughout the whole night?
Yes, that's right.
So basically he's on night shift the whole night, right?
Yes, right. And there will be... it has to meet certain criteria where they are testing for the EEG, the brain waves, the ECG, the heart rhythms, as well as movements. There will be electrodes on the arms, the legs, the face.
How do you sleep?
And then
well?
There will be and then there will be something around the chest to check for the effort to breathe, because then that's how you differentiate central Sleep apnea. For obstructive sleep apnea. Whether there's an effort to breathe, oxygen, flow, carbon dioxide flow. It's a very, very comprehensive study. And this study doesn't only test for sleep apnea. It can test for other parasomnias as well.
Okay.
And so this is a level one study.
Yeah.
The level two study is with the same kind of testing parameters, but can be done at home. So instead of in the hospital, you're doing it at home, but you're unattended. So there's nobody watching you. So what happens, the level two, it can sometimes be slightly inferior to the level one is if the electrodes come loose. Nobody to go in and rectify it and to make sure that the recording is accurate. But in the level one, because there's someone watching you, then so easily they will just come in, you know, and just fix whatever that's loose, it's the signal that's loose, so you can get a really good, accurate recording. And then the level three, which is a home sleep study that can be done as well, is a very much simpler device. Usually level three only is only for detection of obstructive sleep apnea.
Does he need to go for level one or two?
A level three is good enough if there's just, if you're just trying to detect obstructive sleep apnea and there's a very high index of suspicion. So you can do a home sleep study. It can be in a form. There's many devices like a watch pad, a Balan ring, you know. There's many devices that can be done nowadays that's available in the market.
I mean, even the Apple wearable watch as well, you can actually
The Apple Watch, unfortunately, the technology inside there and the sensors is not good enough for diagnostic purposes.
But like maybe a screening tool, maybe perhaps.
Some research is still being done. Not yet approved for that as well.
Good to know, because that means to say that if your Apple Watch tells you that you don't have sleep apnea, you might still have sleep apnea, right? Because maybe it's not as accurate.
Yes, right? Possibly.
So still might want to go and see a doctor for it. Okay, yep. That's a good take home. I would say that a lot of people have sleep apnea. Just that it's not really diagnosed properly. Or like not even diagnosed at all, right?
Yes, possibly.
Because it's like possible. So silent, right? Nobody really know, right?
Silent or maybe very loud at night.
Yeah, but like let's say you're sleeping alone. Yes. Like you wouldn't know, right? I mean, you would just say I'm tired, but people might say, oh, I didn't sleep well, or I didn't sleep enough.
Yes.
I didn't sleep more kind of thing. So, or I have like, you know, I just don't feel motivated to come to work. Sort of thing, right? And so it's very undiagnosed and I would say more in the Asian culture.
Well, I think in the recent years there's more awareness about obstructive sleep apnea right now. But yes, it's still very much not as known. And I mean there was this study that was done back in 2012. There's a Singapore population study. And from that sample they actually found that up to 30% of people in the population have moderate to severe sleep apnea.
30%?
That's a lot. And even then, and out of these people that they sampled to just do a random sleep study, 90% had never had a previous diagnosis. Only 10% had a previous diagnosis of sleep apnea.
Okay, wow, that's a lot.
So it shows that, but of course that was back in 2012 when this study was performed. But that still shows that there's still potentially 90% of people with sleep apnea that has not been diagnosed.
Okay.
Been treated as
well. That's quite severe, really, really. Let's go on. So, you know, as a dentist, general dentist, and there's quite a number of general dentists watching this video as well. How do we actually detect? How can we like sort of screen patients?
I think being a dentist, there is we have certain trainings that allows us to look out for certain things that have been associated with sleep apnea. Firstly is the skeletal form of the patient. So patients with skeletal 2, meaning a more convex facial profile with smaller jawline, short chin, throat length. We are able to then identify that this is, you know, a skeletal 2, and these patients actually do have a higher risk factor.
So yeah, because the jaw is getting pushed back, the tongue is obviously getting pushed back as well, right?
That's right. Yep. Because the tongue is attached to the lower jaw, so it didn't have space to grow forward, and so the tongue is further back, sitting further back. And then the second thing is that actually patients with large torus mandibularis.
So that's like very big, huge, bony outgrowths.
Yeah, bony outgrowths at the lower jaw, just at the area behind the teeth that is next to the tongue. Those can be form like a form of obstruction for the tongue to rest in a forward position, and that pushes the tongue back as well.
Studies
have shown that that's one of the very easy predictors, strong predictors for obstructive sleep apnea as well. And of course, we always look into the patient's mouth, okay, regularly. And if we just get the patient to say, and then just depress their tongue a little bit, we can easily look at their tonsils as well. So if patients have grade 3 or even grade 4, grade 4 means kissing tonsils, tonsils that are touching. And grade 3 is like about 75% of their oropharyngeal space. And these are also strong predictors for obstructive sleep apnea.
So it's just like and then...
Just maybe depress the tongue a little bit. You can easily look at the tonsils.
Yeah, and also like a narrow arch, I think.
So surprisingly, a narrow arch form itself, it's not really proven as a strong predictor of sleep apnea yet. There might be other factors involved as well. So yes, maybe that can be a form as index of suspicion. For patients with sleep apnea and to assess for other clinical signs from there. The other thing that dentists are very good at picking up is bruxism. When we patients, so patients with severe wear facets on the teeth, multiple cracked teeth, history of cracked teeth, you know. So bruxism has also been very closely linked to sleep apnea.
So patients are grinding at night.
Grinding or clenching.
Clenching at night. Because of sleep apnea. How does that usually work?
Actually, the causation factor is not very...
super established, right?
Established yet. There's still a lot of research going into that. There's one theory is that the bruxism itself is to prevent the jaw from falling back, you know, and therefore the as a protective mechanism for the airway. However, it's still not very strong. Evidence for that is still not very strong. So because there are events that happen after the obstruction and after the arousal.
They say it's like a central pattern generation kind of thing. So
They are both sleep disorders, but they're very closely linked. As high as 50% of sleep apnea patients have bruxism, and so that's something that we just look out for.
It's just like what comes first.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So okay. So if it's bruxism, so it doesn't really matter if it's clenching or grinding.
Yes.
There's no. Oh, that's good to know. All right, so let's go on to, I was reading about AI. Now there's a lot of AI going along. Mm-hmm. And there's people like taking these exams, like tests that you can do online. Actually one of our friends developed it, Somnus Sleep. Okay. That's by Eric. I think he did a podcast with us. He has like a screening tool that he that is also on AIA Vitality that he actually people can actually go there and say, okay, I have this, I'm tired at night or I'm feeling fatigued, things like that. Then you can have a score. Then he said, okay, go and see a doctor or see someone, like an expert to get it done. But that's like sort of some way you can actually do a, like a
self-screening.
Self-screening, and then you can go and see a doctor for it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like, I think it's very important that we understand when a patient finds that he has a sleep disorder, who can he see? What type of doctors can he see? And I ask this, sorry to interrupt, but I ask this because Tiffany, my wife, had a back pain. Right? She had a really bad pain. She has eventually was a sleep disorder. And then, she was like, we have two kids. So you like carry kids and like...
Okay,
and then... She, you know, being mothers, she has to carry them a lot.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, more than me. Because like when I try to carry them, it was like, mama or me.
Okay.
So because like I didn't know a sleep disc, I only knew it was back pain because we didn't diagnose it yet.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were so many different types of doctors, like sort of, I wouldn't say marketing, but like saying that they treat back pain. Like, neurologists, neurosurgeons, physiotherapists, then there's orthopedics, and then there's GPs. Then, who do I go to? Like, I really don't know. So, same thing as sleep. Who do you go to? Who's the best doctor to go to? Or what are the avenues that you can go with?
Well, just like, just from the symptom of back pain, there's many people you can see, but for obstructive sleep apnea, or for the symptoms, apart from the dental specialists who have subspecialized in obstructive sleep apnea, you can see a respiratory physician.
Okay.
Who has also has the ability to send you for a test, sleep study, or the ENT doctor as well.
Okay.
Who does testing and assessment. So
yeah.
There's also actually psychiatrists with the interest in sleep, although they have actually they play a very important role in helping to manage insomnia.
Yeah.
And we do have a team of neurologists on board as well. And the neurologists are very much involved in managing of the parasomnias. And
so it's a very multifactorial,
and narcolepsy.
Multidisciplinary team, right?
Yes. Yeah. So in the realm of sleep disorders, we actually have a big multidisciplinary team involved. If you want to zoom in on obstructive sleep apnea, I would say any of these team members are able to
diagnose
and send you for a sleep study as long as they have had training in sleep medicine.
Okay. So I think to say maybe you can see a dentist who is more inclined towards sleep, or any of these doctors that they can actually self-refer.
Yes, that's
to your
right.
Specialty.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
They can just, even if they don't know who to go to and they go to their GP, okay,
yeah.
I'm sure from there they will be referred to the appropriate specialty that can help them.
Is there such a thing, I mean, official title called a sleep doctor?
It's a subspecialty.
So okay.
Yes, it's a subspecialty of sleep medicine,
okay.
Sleep specialist.
Okay.
Yes, rather than a specialty on its own, and the people involved in this subspecialty comes from many different fields.
Oh, okay, got it, understand. Okay, so let's talk about the treatments. So, let's go with the least the most,
okay.
Because it's a spectrum, right? Isn't it? So like if you find yourself have a sleep apnea, and how do I fix it?
Right now, we will always start patients with actually some lifestyle modifications for sure.
Oh, okay.
So meaning if they are overweight, we will get them to try and lose weight, aim for a BMI of 23 and below. Ideally.
That's tough.
Yes, because weight itself has a very strong correlation with sleep apnea.
Yeah.
Obesity and sleep apnea is very strongly correlated. If you can lose weight, you will be able to help reduce the fat accumulation around your throat, around your neck, and that will reduce that pressure that's causing that airway to collapse. So weight loss is very important. And some of these patients are very, very, very morbidly obese, may sometimes even need bariatric surgery to help them. Yes. And of course, so lifestyle modifications also include avoiding alcohol at night.
Tell me more about avoiding alcohol at night.
Because alcohol is a depressant. So it actually causes your airway muscles to relax even more.
Okay.
And they're more likely to collapse when you're sleeping. Okay.
Okay.
Same thing with sedatives. Medications, sleeping pills, medications that make you sedated, they will actually depress once again your central nervous system.
So your quality of sleep is decreased even though you eat.
Alcohol itself, aside from sleep apnea, can affect your quality of sleep because it actually...
There's some REM.
Yes, it reduces your deep sleep. Yeah, and you're more likely to have REM shifts, and you're more likely to have some disruption in your sleep cycles.
Yeah, that's why I notice also sometimes when I drink a bit more than I should, then you initially get super sleepy because you're like sort of high.
Depressed.
And, depressed. Yes. You sleep, but then I always wake up at 3 a.m.
Yep.
or 4 a.m. and then you try to go back to sleep again. But it's not as restful as, not having alcohol.
Yes, exactly that.
Which is very interesting because I thought when you drink so much alcohol, you're sleeping like a cow for the whole entire
yes,
period, right? Okay. Yeah.
Yes. And then we move on to, going back to options, options. So then other than lifestyle changes, then the next thing is, we always offer patients a conservative option of management first.
Mm.
So the two conservative options available are CPAP, which is a continuous pressure airway there's a machine that pushes air, pressurized air into your lungs to keep your airway open. And then that's something that you need to wear on your face throughout the night, okay? And there's another one, is the mandibular advancement device. So you wear that in your mouth, on your upper and lower teeth, and that pushes your lower jaw forward, keeping your airway open. So these are the two conservative options that we offer patients. Oftentimes for mild to moderate OSA, the mandibular advancement device can work very well. But for the very severe OSA, we still advise them to try CPAP first, as a first line.
But CPAP, like I've had a few of my patients say that I don't want to do CPAP because it's very hard to sleep with. It's like a mask that you like, you sound like Darth Vader.
Yes. So of course, getting the correct mask fit is very important.
Yes. Yes.
And despite that, some patients often do reject it because of comfort reasons. They feel like there's something strapped. If they turn a lot, if they're the kind of toss and turn a lot in their sleep, this mask is likely going to get loose. And then it's going to cause the air to, for them to swallow air instead. Because then the air pressure is not going directly into their lungs. They can end up feeling a feeling of bloatedness. It just leaks and it causes a lot of discomfort. And yes, it kind of sounds like a bit like Darth Vader because the machine is having this pressurized sound. Yeah. Next to them.
Yeah.
Although I would say the sound itself doesn't affect them. It may affect the bed partners.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like you escape from snoring, but you go to Darth Vader.
Yes. So unfortunately, the acceptance of CPAP is not very high. Only about 30% of patients who...
So they buy the machine. You say, okay, I don't want to use it anymore. Or they have a trial.
There's a trial. There's a 1 month loan period where you can just loan the machine and then see whether it's something that you can tolerate and accept before you purchase the machine.
Oh, yes. Wow. Okay. Yeah, yeah, it's a good idea. It's a really good idea.
Yes.
We do quite a bit of MAD, mandibular advancement device, which literally is a device to just advance the jaw, right? The lower jaw. It's quite good and compliant. People are a lot more compliant about it. Is there one that you recommend? Like, you know, there's like different types of...
Well, there's definitely many different devices in the market. Yeah. But certainly you want to look for a device that's titratable.
Okay, firstly, so you can move it.
And then you can titrate the patient and you need to continue to assess their sleep together with it and determine at what point, you know, that you titrate them until... And different patients may tolerate different devices better. So it depends on their teeth, you know, whether they have short clinical crowns and what are the retention factors for each device.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And so these are some of the factors that we need to take into consideration when we are choosing the correct device for the patient and when we are watching the patients closely, because bite changes can also be one of the side effects wearing a mandibular advancement device. Yeah.
So going from the conservative, so how do they know it's not working? Do they go to another sleep study and say, hey, it's not working?
Yes, of course.
Okay.
We have to, for anyone who actually, you know, administers or a mandibular advancement device, it's very important that we do another study, assess, is this treatment working for them? Because if this treatment is not working for them, then we need to consider other options. If they have failed all the conservative treatments, then is it the surgery that they need to go to? If the patient is very averse towards surgery, do they want to give CPAP another shot with a better mask fit, with a better pressure setting, different type of pressure algorithms? And this can all... help, you know, get them to be more comfortable with it. So, because if not, we're not really treating the sleep apnea, and then that can still come with all the comorbids of untreated sleep apnea.
So, I mean, in terms of conservative sort of treatment, you mentioned about CPAP and also the MAD.
Mm-hmm.
Is braces or Invisalign, can it help with sleep apnea as part of a conservative sort of treatment?
Unfortunately, braces alone is not going to be able to treat sleep apnea. Are you talking about in the sense of expansion? Doing an expansion?
Yeah, but not skeletal.
There are some studies that show that if you do a maxillary expansion, you can improve nasal airway breathing. Okay. I think we're still looking at really how efficacious, because alone it may not be really treating sleep apnea. There are many, even nasal surgery, just removing the enlarged turbinates or deviated septum that's causing nasal obstruction, can have some effect for very mild, for mild sleep apnea. Mm. So I think for the same reason, the expansion that increases the airway, the nasal airway width, and therefore reduces the nasal obstruction, can perhaps help for only the mild cases.
Okay.
But alone is not going to be able to maybe do a very significant effect on the moderate or even severe sleep apnea. Yeah.
Okay, got it. Okay, cool. So let's talk about surgery. What do you do? Seems like you got to cut out stuff to remove the obstruction.
For me, my role, I play a unique role, and yeah. I don't cut off stuff, actually. I actually reposition patients' jaws in a forward position.
Yeah.
Thereby opening up the airway. So the soft palate is connected to the upper jaw, mm-hmm. and the tongue is connected to the lower jaw.
Yeah.
So by pulling the jaws forward, I am actually opening up the airway.
Mm.
And then putting the tissues in the airway under some tension.
Yeah.
Therefore reducing the collapsibility.
So imagine, you're making like you're hardening it up.
Yeah. So imagine if your house is collapsing.
Yeah.
Your foundation is now weak.
Yeah.
Okay, and your house is collapsing, it's getting a bit cramped. Two ways, right? You either rebuild the foundation, put your house in a better foundation, prevent it from collapsing.
Yeah.
I mean, the other option is if your house is overcrowded,
yeah.
for reason, then you take out some furniture.
Yeah.
That you don't need. So then, then removing tonsils, you know.
That's what
sort of like removing the excess furniture that you don't need.
Yes.
To make the house less cramped. And then, but jaw surgery, maxillomandibular advancement surgery is like rebuilding the foundation of the house, expanding it outwards. Yeah.
Okay. But do you remove the tonsils also at the same time?
If the tonsils are very enlarged,
yeah.
They can be removed, at the same time, or you can be staged. They can be removed first, you know, or they can be removed later, whichever it is.
Ah, so, okay, that's really, really interesting. Now, when you move the jaw, I think a lot of people ask, do you affect the profile of the face?
Yes, sure. The profile of the face will be affected.
Okay.
But we will still try our best. Although at this point, I would say...
Is it like plastic surgery, I guess?
In a way. In a way, okay. So I never promise my patients that they look better. So I'm not sure whether we can call it plastic surgery.
Yeah.
Because the emphasis here and the priority here is the airway.
Yeah.
So my priority is not to make them look like a superstar, a K-pop star.
They might want to say, hey, might as well just do it together.
Yes,
right?
So, yeah. But there are some patients of mine who say, no, I just want to breathe better. I just want to be able to sleep better.
Yeah.
I don't really care how I look.
Yeah.
I'm going to accept whatever you give me. I just want to be able to breathe better, right?
Yeah.
And then there are some patients, of course the younger ones, who are still very concerned about the appearance. So this is a discussion we'll have together. And then move the jaw into something that they can accept. So we give them simulations, show them how they will look like, the predictions of how they will look like after surgery. And from there, we can discuss whether this is something they can accept, what is the best plan for the airway. And sometimes, yes, if they really can't accept the best plan for the airway,
it's like the balance
then
between
we go to
aesthetics.
A B, yes, then we go to a B plan that will balance the aesthetics.
Okay. So,
and do some other combination treatment.
In a way, you have to also talk about aesthetics as well, because it's
definitely, because it does affect the face, yes,
okay,
for sure.
Okay.
But a lot of the men, especially with small lower jaws, generally they actually like having that much stronger stronger jaw appearance. And so far I don't have any complaints from my patients that they look worse. Very, you know, most of them are very accepting of their new look. Some love it even. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, I guess it's so you're building back where nature should have. It's also usually looks aesthetics. Right, that's from a dentist point of view, from a veneer mm-hmm. guy point of view.
Yeah.
okay, cool. And during the procedure as well, I guess you get also people saying, hey, my face looks a bit crooked, can I fix the face, things like that. Like, that's also something you have to talk to them as well.
Definitely. When I'm doing the facial analysis for them, if I do see some asymmetries, some can, I'll inform them that there's all these things that are also present that I noticed and that I will fix it. I will actually correct them. And some patients don't never did notice it until
until
I pointed it out to them.
Yeah.
Some patients already noticed it, didn't really bother them too much, but happy to have it corrected at the same time. So then we're killing a few birds with one stone, you know. For some patients with very deep bites, class 2 deep bites, you know, we are correcting their bite, we are improving their airway, we are improving their facial profile and aesthetics. So these are things that we can all solve it with one surgery, actually.
Okay, and that's called orthodontic surgery, am I right?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, and also, I think a lot of the viewers would ask, do I need to do teeth straightening, like you know, braces or Invisalign before doing surgery or after doing surgery? Is that something that I have to do if I
Well, for patients with mild occlusions, and very bad bite patterns that may not be favorable to the teeth in the long run, oftentimes we definitely will push for braces to be done as well.
Is it before?
Depends on the bite setup. We can do it as braces first, align the teeth sometimes. Some patients need that before we can go for the surgery and have a better stable bite. Some patients will do surgery first and then they do the braces after. Yeah. However, we do have another group of patients that they might actually already had a round of braces done. When they were younger, when they had a class 2 bite, they already extracted 2 upper premolars.
Yeah.
They already camouflaged their bite. Some even extracted 4 teeth and camouflaged their bite.
Yeah.
And so for this group of patients, we actually offer surgery only. Just by keeping the bite and then moving the jaw.
So you're literally, the bites are there, you're just literally moving it forward. Like
yes, and maybe some rotations and things like that. But you're just keeping
but in the same coordinates.
Yes.
Okay.
That's right.
Ooh, wow. Okay. Yeah, because I think there's a lot of misconception that people say, hey, you're gonna, you know, move your jaw forward for the airway. You have to do some Invisalign first or braces first to sort it out, which is a lot more, time consuming and people might not want to do it.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, cool. And after, if I do the surgery, what's the recovery period like?
So I just tell my patients that prepare for 1 month of downtime.
1 month, okay.
Yes, their face is really going to swell up.
Yeah.
Okay, and I even use the word 猪八戒, you know, or even like, you know, you really swell out like a fishball sometimes.
Okay.
And it'll take time for all that swelling to go down because of the surgery. And usually by 1 month after surgery, they are looking very pretty much back to their a normal appearance. I would say a changed appearance, but at least the swelling is mostly gone. They are able to resume their daily activities. They are able to, at that point, go back to even rice, you know, for some patients, or at least not hard food yet, but at least quite a normal diet, avoiding hard food. Yeah.
Okay. So for the first month, what's the diet like?
The first 1 to 2 weeks will be liquid diet, actually.
Okay.
We'll give them a special drink that's all the nutrition that they need for a meal replacement.
Okay.
And then the second week onwards, they're on pureed food already. So they can be on thicker soups, they can be on things like yogurt, soft boiled eggs, and steam eggs and stuff like that. And then slowly from there, and porridge, of course, like baby porridge. Okay, everything has to be rinsed. And then slowly we step up the consistency of their food from there. So by actually 4 to 6 weeks, they're actually back to rice and noodles, but avoiding hard food still for at least a good 3 to 6 months. Yeah.
Now, if you think that the jaw is sort of, what if a patient says, hey, my jaw is really nice, really, I don't want to change my profile at all. Can I just remove the obstructions, like the stuff in the way?
So if the patient is not willing for a change in appearance, then of course the MME surgery will not be for them.
Yeah.
And then in this group of patients, if they have also failed conservative therapy, it would be best to do a DICE, which stands for a drug-induced sleep endoscopy, which means we put them in an artificial sleep state. Okay, and then this usually is done by the ENT doctor. So then they will do a scope, okay, to see where is the areas of obstruction, okay? And from there, they can decide which is the best soft tissue surgery that is for them. Because soft tissue surgery is not a multi-level surgery. Multi-level meaning targeting all levels of the upper airway. they are often very targeted at certain areas, okay? And so they need to actually see where's the areas of obstruction to decide what surgery would do and would be effective for them. Yeah. Even for the hypoglossal nerve stimulation, which is one of the, I would say, latest invention in sleep apnea therapy, is they need to actually see whether they meet certain criteria. What is the pattern of collapse of the airway in the sleep and whether they're suitable candidates for it.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Got it. No, because I got a few patients of ours to say, I don't want to move. I'm happy with my face. I just want to cure my sleep apnea once and for all.
Okay. Yeah. Unfortunately, no magic surgery that can... every patient is unique. Yeah.
Every patient. Yeah, you're right. And is there a reoccurrence again? Like after you do a jaw surgery?
Yes. I always tell my patients that, you know, sleep apnea can occur, can recur. Because if they put on a lot of weight, then obesity becomes a factor that can cause sleep apnea to recur. And as we age, as we grow older, we will lose muscle tone again.
Yeah, more flabby.
Everything becomes more flabby. So there's that possibility of it recurring again
with
age. So healthy lifestyle, important. Yeah. And also keeping yourself, you know, in a fit and a healthy condition is very important. Yeah.
Okay. I think people will always ask, what if I just sleep on the side? Will it be better?
Well, possibly.
The tongue goes down, right?
The tongue may be less likely to fall back.
Yeah, yeah.
But not all patients are positional sleep apnea. So based on the sleep study, we can tell, based on the sleeping position.
Oh, really?
Whether they are more of a positional, affected by position or not, and whether positional therapy is going to help with them. So for these patients, yes, we could do position, if they're very mild, positional therapy alone could be sufficient. Otherwise, we might need some combination of mandibular advancement device and positional therapy. Okay. Yeah.
Very cool. Very, very cool. Now, with all this, there's a lot of hype about sleep medicine now. It's like, I think in Singapore, it's getting really, really, really popular. Everybody's talking about it. I got some patients just coming to me and say, I want to get a sleep apnea device. I don't want a sleep study. I want to just try it out and things like that. And it's getting really popular, I said. So, and what do you think sort of fueled this whole entire interest?
I think over the past few years, all the specialists in sleep medicine have been putting up more efforts in increasing the awareness of sleep disorders. Mm. Yeah. So with that, with all the education and with all this, awareness that's been going out, outreach, you know, then patients are getting more and more aware of it. And of course, with even celebrities coming out and telling people that, hey, you know, actually I have sleep apnea.
Yeah.
And after being treated, you know, it kind of changed my life. And these people did help to create more awareness of it and more acceptance about it, about having these sleep disorders. Yeah. So it's good that there's people that are getting more aware of it. But at the same time, I think with this awareness, it's important that, you know, as healthcare professionals, we play a role in making sure that that every patient gets properly diagnosed, gets properly treated.
Yes, I think the diagnosis part is very important.
And gets properly assessed that they are treated efficiently, you know. Rather than, there's no one-size-fits-all treatment, and we have to be very careful, you know, to avoid a situation where we have a hammer, then everything looks like a nail, you know. Yeah, and just be cognizant of all the different options there are and what we can do to offer, you know, to offer these patients so that they can have the choice or even be best fitted for the treatment that would work best for them. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, absolutely right. Mm. So, cool, very cool. Very, very, very cool. I want to talk more about now. I think we're done with sleep apnea, right?
Okay, sure.
I mean, it's great that we have so much knowledge now about this. Now, with regards to teeth transplantation, I want to know, this is so cool. And you're probably the only few doctors in Singapore that actually do teeth auto transplantation. All right, I think so. Tell me more about teeth auto transplantation.
Well, autotransplantation is moving a tooth from one position in a patient's own mouth to another position to replace a missing tooth.
Yes.
Okay. And so, and it actually has existed for many, many years, for centuries even.
Yeah.
And way more, much earlier than dental implants. Yeah. So okay. It actually has come from a long history. And in the past, people even took allotransplantation, meaning teeth from another person, to plant it into a different person's mouth.
I wonder how that works.
I think because of a transmission of diseases and rejection, you know, compatibility issues, then that practice has fallen out of favor. But in today's context, I think whilst it's no longer as popular and no longer as remembered, I think it definitely still has a very important role to play in dentistry, especially in children.
So in teeth transplantation, you're saying you're taking your own tooth, and because you have a missing tooth over there, or you need to take out that tooth.
Yes.
You're taking one tooth from somewhere, usually like a wisdom tooth, I guess.
Depends what you're trying to replace.
Yeah.
Because you have to transplant teeth with compatible size.
Yes.
So let's say a child fell down, evolves the front teeth.
The tooth.
And then tooth was replaced, but after a while, did not survive or has infection. So then the most common transplant candidate we would use to replace it would be actually a lower premolar.
Ah, okay.
So in such patients, when they're very young, you can't do dental implants for them. They're still growing and the dental implant doesn't grow with the jawbone. So then autotransplantation comes as a very good option, a biologic replacement option for them. Yeah. And, you know, the front tooth can affect your own confidence and your own image. So it's definitely not, most people will not like to have that gap there, even children, or they may not like to wear dentures.
And it's your own tooth. So,
correct.
Yeah,
and your own tooth totally will grow with you.
Yes, yes. And you don't have like complications that we are seeing so much with implants, or even though it's a successful treatment, but it's nothing beats your own tooth.
Biologic replacement is definitely the best.
Yeah, it's the best, right?
Yes.
Not many people do it because implants are so popular and they're so much easier to it was so much more straightforward compared to doing a teeth autotransplantation.
Yes.
Right? And essentially what you're trying to do is you're trying to take out the new tooth, and you're trying to put it into that space again, right?
Yes, that's right.
And so you really have to make sure the size is like...
The size has to be similar, and you need to prepare the recipient side, which is to receive this tooth. You need to make sure that socket is well prepared so that you can just...
So the blood supply is going to help.
And the size fits, and you're not going to have it under too much pressure. Yeah.
Okay.
So there's a lot of... you need to do some planning, before you can actually make sure that you reduce that time that the tooth is spent out of its home. Yeah, out of this biological home. Usually my transplant is out and in 5 seconds. And
done. Because you want to make sure that there's no cells that die.
Correct. And all the cells survive.
Yeah.
So that they can form a healthy connection again.
Yes. Okay, that's real cool. Can you tell me, because there's a lot of also people who listen who are also having missing teeth, a lot of them are on the molars, right? Mm-hmm. So, because that's where the most common area of tooth loss is, right?
Yep.
And so, is it possible for us to take a wisdom tooth and then put it onto this side?
Yes.
And it's in a perfectly healed side. How does that work?
In a perfectly healed side,
yeah,
it's possible to do an autotransplant.
Mm-hmm.
The only caveat is there enough bone to house, let's say, the wisdom tooth that was removed?
Mm-hmm.
Because as we all know, once we remove a tooth and lose a tooth, oftentimes there will be, the bone will actually shrink, you know, resorb.
Yep.
And therefore, one of the factors ensure success is that you need to have sufficient bone to house the transplanted tooth.
So provided there's sufficient bone.
So if there is sufficient bone, you could do it.
Mm-hmm.
But honestly, in an adult patient, there will be a lot much more bone that you need to remove to house a transplant compared to a dental implant.
Yes. You know, but some people are very holistic.
Yes. So, but if there are some patients who are very adverse against implants,
yes,
definitely. And if there's sufficient bone,
it's possible.
Then auto transplant is definitely still a possible option, replacement option.
Yeah, it's, I think the key is, the important thing is whether there's enough bone. And often, like you say, it's not enough bone at all.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I have done transplants of wisdom teeth to molar sites.
Yeah.
Usually simultaneously removing the broken down tooth
and then transplanting. The hole is already there and the bone is still haven't strengthened yet, right?
Yes, that's right. Okay. And with, as long as, even if you don't have 100% bone, the periodontal ligament cells, the PDL cells, have the ability to regenerate and form new bone. Mm. So we don't need 100%, we just need a good amount. Yeah.
Mm. And how long do you, when you put in a new tooth into that socket, how long does it take to heal and like get so the patient can chew again?
Generally, it can take anywhere between 2 weeks to 1 month. I would tell patients to actually avoid biting on the tooth. To avoid
2 weeks to 1 month, that's really fast though. I mean, implant takes about 3 months, right?
Yeah. Well, in a way, yes. The loading protocol for implants is 2 to 3 months. But, you know, in a way, you can, for a transplanted tooth, generally, biologics, you see, we have the PDL cells forming a healthy,
as long as there's blood supply, and
so actually it's just 2 weeks to 1 month. It's just like a Avals tooth. When you replant an Avals tooth, you just splint it for 2 weeks. Thereafter, patients can't really avoid it completely because it is in contact with the opposing tooth. So as long as there's some, and in fact, some physiologic you want some physiologic stimulation to prevent ankylosis, which is the unhealthy union of with their bone. So that actually helps with prevention of ankylosis.
It's faster than implants, so it's
very different. The biology behind it is
totally different. Totally understand. Oh, wow! I think it's a good. I know who to refer to for this. Really, it's something beyond me, man. Cool. I think that's all from us. Is there anything else you want to add as well, since you're here?
Actually, I'm just really happy to have this opportunity to share more about obstructive sleep apnea and I guess a little bit about auto transplant.
I really enjoyed this conversation. I think that it's sort of, there's a lot of, I wouldn't say alchemy, but there's a lot of unknowns about, or folklore about sleep apnea. Right? There's also people saying, hey, you gotta sleep, you gotta try this special pillow or special bed, you know, like things like that, and then a different set. I mean, this can may work or play a factor in this, but it's so much so multifactorial that we sort of need to get an expert to talk about it and learn more about it. Yeah.
I guess for the general population, generally when it comes to sleep, there's a lot of unknown. When you talk about those special pillows, special scents, you know, because sometimes people who have trouble, they don't know what's the issue, you see, whether is it insomnia, whether is it difficulty falling asleep. Some people have difficulty maintaining sleep. And this could be, there can be many causes, multifactorial, and why they are tired in a day. You know, sometimes it's not all just sleep apnea. It could be the other factors in their sleep. And that's why, there's a lot of folklore about how things can be done. But, most importantly is if they feel like it's something that's bothering them, affecting their quality of life, that they seek help, come and see a sleep specialist.
Yes.
And from there, we can look at it, help them look at it in a holistic way and see exactly what is the cause. But sometimes it may not just be obstructive sleep apnea itself. Yeah, there can be other issues that
can be really other issues.
Yes.
I want to ask a question before we finish. There are a lot of people asking us about kids having sleep apnea.
Yes.
And my kids are snoring.
Mm-hmm.
And my kid was snoring. I know how I handled it, but what's your management? People ask you like, my kid is snoring or?
So for children, I think oftentimes they might actually have some form of nasal obstruction.
Okay,
and one of the very common cause of them snoring, apart from nasal obstruction, is enlarged adenoids or even enlarged tonsils. Children do have enlarged adenoids and tonsils, and oftentimes they will shrink as the child ages. Yeah. But if it is something that's affecting their sleep, causing them to have noisy breathing in their sleep or not sleeping well, then they should be assessed. They need to be checked and see whether...
Because they're not supposed to snore, right?
Yes. Unfortunately, yeah. Children are not supposed to snore. They're supposed to be very good sleepers.
Yes. Because people, I think parents think that, hey, snoring is so cute, you know, like things like that. But it's not. It's bad for your kids.
Yes, it's not good. So I think it's important. And for the children, because of these factors, I would say it would be good to see an ENT specialist to be assessed and to see whether... could it be allergic rhinitis, causing a lot of mucus production? And this minimally, these children may need to be placed on a nasal spray to help with the congestion and some nasal wash as well. Nasal wash followed by nasal spray. And if really, if it's enlarged adenoids and tonsils, then we need to observe, is it how badly enlarged? Do they need to be removed in the severe cases? Or can we adopt a watch and wait and see whether that improves with time? Yeah.
I mean, coming from my own story of,
your own
my
son,
kid,
right?
my kid actually had snoring and sleeping. He was only like 2-3 years old.
Mm.
And then we saw an ENT and then we noticed that he was really, really restless. He couldn't concentrate in class. And then in his school, the teachers were complaining about him and say, hey, your son cannot keep concentrate in class, things like that. And they were saying that, hey, this guy, he might be of special needs. And I'm like, cannot be here. Like, I mean, obviously, I know my kid very well. And the way he acts is at home is very different from the way he acts in class. We thought about it, and it's because in school, in class, he doesn't sleep. He can't sleep because imagine he have a bad sleep at night already, then he go to class and that break time to sleep, he doesn't really sleep because he doesn't sleep over there. And then he gets super restless. But at home he takes a nap every day. So that's why he is okay. But then we had it checked out and then he had to remove his tonsils, adenoids, and there's one more thing. Terminates. So the whole thing. So after that he's okay. His mood changed, things like that.
Fantastic.
Yeah, but like, it's so hard to define. And I'm sure, I mean, luckily I'm a medical professional, so I could tell the difference between the special needs and things like that. Mm-hmm. But it could really go into a rabbit hole of like, okay, a wrong diagnosis will set you on a different path because imagine he was said to be a special needs and he goes into a different path of education, things like that, which a proper diagnosis is so important. Yeah. Yes. So get it checked out, you know, especially if the kids are snoring.
Yes. Noisy sleep and then some teeth grind. Some children have that noisy sleep plus teeth grinding. Yeah. So these are all things that might be signals.
Yeah. How we actually something found out, right, was because we had a webcam in our room. And then the webcam will detect movements, right? So then when how come my webcam is detecting movement? Like, it was at least like 40 times a night. Moving.
So he'll be flipping.
He'll just
flipping, turning,
or he'll sit up, and then he'll go back down.
Yes.
Yeah. Then he'll be like, oh no, there's something wrong. So
that's his body trying to tell him to breathe.
Very, very. And the thing is that he doesn't remember at all when he wakes up. And he's like, oh, I had a good sleep. Then he like, yeah.
For children, it's very hard for them to tell. They don't know how to tell what's wrong. If they are very young, they may not have that language to communicate as well. And they may not have that awareness.
You're right.
That it's good that you were very quick to pick it up and get him help, you know.
Luckily I'm in the dental profession. We can pick it up earlier.
Yes.
Okay. So I think with that, thank you so much for having us today.
No, thank you for having me.
It was so good. I look forward to coming back. You coming back again.
Okay. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you so much, everyone.
Thank you, everyone.
See you then.
Bye.